This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Jonathan Aull, in for Greg Shanley. Today, we'll talk about Johannes Brahms. Iowa Public Radio music host Barney Sherman has recently published articles about Brahms in French and American music journals. Brahms is most often performed by modern orchestras and ensembles on modern instruments. But there have been efforts to play this music on the kind of instruments that were available at the time. Why do they do it, and which way is better? And how does the technology of the French horn play into it? We'll talk about it with Barney Sherman. Then in the second half of the program, Doug Cooper will have agriculture news from ISU Extension. That's coming up on Talk of Iowa, after a check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, in for Greg Shanley. Coming up in about 25 minutes, Doug Cooper will be by with agriculture news from ISU Extension. But in this half hour, we're going to be talking about Brahms. And we're going to be talking about Brahms with one of our residence experts, Barney Sherman, one of the classical announcers here on Iowa Public Radio. Barney, welcome to the news side of things and to Talk of Iowa.
Nice to be here, Jonathan.
You are a published author on Brahms. You've written a book on it. You also have an article that's coming out very soon in a pretty important music journal. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. Well, last year, I got this request out of the blue from France to write an article about Brahms and historical instrument people. Is anything happening? It's an article, a magazine called Diapason. So I said, okay, I'll write it. I said, and when does it due? They said 3 weeks. So I spent 3 weeks working really hard. And one thing that I did was I had a little sidebar to make it manageable on Brahms and his special relationship with the horn. And then I thought, you know, there's a lot there. I want to explore that some more. So I approached Early Music America. That's coming out next month. It's called Brahms, the Horn, and History.
So what relationship did Brahms have with the horn, or what some of us call the French horn, that may remember it from band when we were in junior high? What was his relationship with this instrument?
Well, here's the thing. He was born in 1833, died in 1897. This is like Industrial Revolution. Technology, industry are really changing the world a lot during his lifetime. And for the most part, he was excited about, you know, new gadget, new scientific discovery. It was like cool to him. But the real and he liked new instruments, like pianos, totally changed in his lifetime. They just really developed the modern piano, and he just embraced it. But with a horn, it was different. He liked old-fashioned horns. The big change in the horn was this new technology called the valve. Now, if anybody out there has seen an orchestra, you've seen the horn players, they have these little valves they depress with one of their hands, and that lets them play all the notes in the scale smoothly with an even tone, and they can play in tune, and they can – it's great. It's a great advance. He didn't like it. He liked the old valveless hand horn. So that was like – that's what I'm exploring there. Why is it that he –
when you say
special relationship to the horn.
A valveless horn, that's kind of like a bugle of sorts, but bigger and longer and more conical. But
right.
But it's that kind of where you don't touch anything. All the notes change with your mouth.
So your lips – the other thing they did was the hand. They'd stick the hand into the bell of the horn. Mm-hmm. Between that, they could play a scale. But the different tones, the ones that were open that you just blew into it and the ones that were stopped by the hand sounded different. Well, horn players were loving this new instrument with valves, but there were people around. Brahms wasn't the only one who thought something had been lost or trade-offs. You know, I think of it as being like the difference – you can think of it as the difference between an acoustic and an electric guitar. An electric guitar can do all kinds of things that an acoustic can't do. You know, you can – play like Jimi Hendrix, you can do tremolo, you can do all these things, but you lose something. There's a kind of resonance on the acoustic guitar. And the horn was like that. There were trade-offs. And this was one thing where Brahms, he said, now here's the other thing about him, is there a relationship between what he was writing and expecting to happen and what he really wanted? He said, you know, I write for these Waldhorns, these old hand horns, but I never expect to hear them. Nobody's actually going to use them anymore. So you look at his writing, and it's true. It turns out that he wrote all the parts, even in his symphonies and concertos, so they could be played on the old hand horns, but he knew nobody would ever do it. Well, nowadays, there are people who are doing it. That's what I was writing about in the Diapason thing. There's this orchestra in John Elliott Gardner's Period Instrument Group. The horn players, it wasn't the conductor. The horn player said, hey, we want to do this thing on old hand horns, and we can do it, and they did. So that's what I was writing about.
So it's not just an issue of whether the horn had valves or not, but it also had to do with what the character of the horn sound was. So yeah. He was kind of, I guess now we'd call him retro or throwback. He was really thinking more towards, because horns had a very practical application at one time in their life.
They started out with Louis XIV. They were used in hunting parties. They were out on horses, you know, somebody – you know, had the fox cornered, they had a hunting horn that they didn't have walkie-talkies. They used a horn. Well, it went indoors from there, from being an, you know, just a signaling instrument to being something used in music. And then it went from there, they started developing the technology. But the big advances in the 19th century with the valves, Brahms is being retro. And the thing that I go into is it's not just – it was part of its music. Part of it is he liked the sort of responsiveness of the old horn. But part of it might be not just the music but the associations, as we have for instruments. I mean, for us, I was mentioning the steel guitar. There's lots of instruments that for us kind of mean something. Well, for him, the horn had all kinds of meanings it doesn't have for us. You know, I think of the horn in pop music today, and I think of the Beach Boys, God Only Knows, or I think of the Beatles, For No One. There's a horn solo. It's very melancholy. The Shins have a song, Pink Bullets, I think. But the 19th century person like Brahms, it had a lot of other meanings. It related to hunting. We can see why. Mm-hmm. But it had come to mean other things. The outdoors, the wilds, woodsmen, the forest, distances like you have in the forest, the mysteries of the night in the forest. It had even historical distance. You thought of medieval bards and that sort of thing. It meant all those things to Brahms. And when you go into those, then you understand why he wrote for the horn the way he did. Certain things in his music, like the Second Symphony, might be able to play some of that. The opening has some horn calls. They're evoking the wilds and the distances and all of that. I mean, it's not just about the sound. It's about the meaning of the instrument, too.
So who of Brahms' contemporaries might have had a different approach to the horn? Like, how did Wagner treat it, for example?
Good question. Wagner wrote amazing stuff for the horn, and he and Brahms, in their time, their followers perceived them as being opposites, politically, musically, totally different visions of music. Wagner's the music of the future, Brahms the conservative. Politically, it kind of turned out differently. But the funny thing is, regarding the horn, Wagner had some of the same ambivalence about the new horn that Brahms did. He said, you know, you lose some delicacy and the ability to slur between notes and kind of the differentiation between notes with these new valved horns. I kind of regret losing the old horns. But from Tristan and Isolde, which is, you know, like 1865, I think. No, I don't know the dates now. But from Tristan and the Ring Cycle, he is writing for the modern horn. And yet there's a really famous horn call in Wagner. Siegfried, this forest man, plays a horn solo, and a lot of that could be played on one of the old wood horns. Not all of it, but a lot of it. So he dealt with sort of the same associations as Brahms, but his musical inclinations took him to wholeheartedly adopt the new horn. So there's a pretty interesting contrast there.
What about what was Brahms' relationship with horn, and what was the impact on that for composers to come in the future? Do you think that – I mean, was Brahms kind of the last of these throwback people, and composers in the future just kind of embraced the new technology and different relationships with that instrument?
More or less for the most part. Now, there was one thing that was going on was there were a lot of differences in different parts of Europe, and it happened that it was in France, you know, where this all started with Louis XIV, that horn players basically kind of by act, you know, just by who happened to be there, really stuck to the old hand horn. And it was the primary instrument taught at the Paris Conservatory into the 20th century, the early 20th century. And the last place you can hear it is something by Maurice Ravel, the Pavane for a Dead Princess. It's a horn solo, and he specifies that it should be played on a natural horn. And
even though that melody is very kind of what you were talking about with, you know, the Beatles and the Beach Boys.
Yeah,
it's kind of
like
that melancholy, longing type sound.
Right.
But Ravel wanted it played on a natural horn.
And I think that's because that piece is like it's evoking the past. It's evoking this, you know, story that takes place in medieval times, a princess. And that may be why he asked for it. It almost never happens. I do have a recording using that, but came out last year actually, a recording using the natural horn. The thing about it, though, was that really was sort of the end. And pretty much during the 20th century, horns go through a whole lot more evolution. It didn't stop during the 19th century. There's this thing called a double horn that gets invented, which it got invented in the same year Brahms died. And by the mid-20th century, that's taken over. That's the standard horn you'd see in an orchestra now. Well, and the other thing is horns – After World War II, all the instruments start getting more powerful. The violins, for example, they now use steel strings. Well, that took place over the first third of the century. That really is between the two world wars that really takes over. And instruments get more powerful, and horns got more powerful.
And that sounds like a lot of the things that we're going to talk about in our next segment, where we're going to talk a little bit about performance.
Okay.
And period instruments and how Brahms fits all in that and some other writing that you've done. Barney Sherman, Iowa Public Radio classical music host, is our guest on Talk of Iowa. Heading up to the break, we're going to hear a little more horn music of Brahms. This is the Scherzo from the Horn Trio, a little more about Brahms' relationship to the horn. We'll be right back here on Talk of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, filling in for Greg Shanley. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, Doug Cooper will be by with agriculture news from ISU Extension. In this half hour, we're talking about Brahms, period instruments, and how classical music is performed from time to time with Barney Sherman. He's our guest. He is the morning classical music host on Iowa Public Radio Classical and also a published author on both Brahms and on performance techniques in some early music. Barney, we were talking before the break about the horn, but in general, Brahms's music, how did people who look at performing, how do modern performers looked at performing Brahms music, both from the standpoint of do they try to do it the way that Brahms wanted it to be done, or do they do it in the context of a modern orchestra, I guess?
Interesting question. It starts with stuff that goes on basically in the 50s and 60s. People started to experiment with old instruments. There's a person named Nicholas Harnoncourt. I'm not saying it right. He says it many different ways. But anyway, in Vienna, and they start playing things like Bach and earlier composers on old instruments. It kind of gets into public awareness in the late 60s and 70s, By the 80s, it is selling records. There's a whole thing called the early music movement. Okay, so for me, my involvement was in this book I wrote in sort of the first half of the 1990s. It was like, okay, so all these people now, like, they're recording Beethoven symphonies with old instruments. What is it that they're claiming? Why do they play it that way? What's the story? And that was what that first book was about. And I tried to take, you know, an even-handed, somewhat skeptical, but also, you know, really let the performers talk about what it's like for them. Mm-hmm. Anyway, what happened was they started with old music, but they kind of advanced into music that was already in the mainstream, music of Beethoven and Brahms and Mozart, and even got up to Ravel last year and play it on period instruments. And there were things going on that were, you know, referred to as turf wars. You know, there were, you know, volleys fired from both sides and insults and put downs and all of that. And what I think has happened since then is kind of fruitful, you know, interactions and coexistence. So you can go to somebody like the Berlin Philharmonic, the ultimate, you know, modern instrument orchestra. They and their conductor, Sir Simon Rattle, many of them have a lot of experience with playing, say, Bach or Beethoven period instruments and thinking about what that means. And so I think there's a lot of kind of not necessarily adoption of historical knowledge, but interest in it, knowledge of it, finding it interesting, finding it stimulating, something that you know, a musician can maybe use some of but not all of. I think there's a lot of people who can now play in both worlds. It's gone from being this kind of self-consciously revolutionary group to being just part of the spectrum of what goes on in classical performance.
Now, I'm thinking about what corollaries non-musicians may be able to come out of this. And I'm thinking that on the one hand, you'd probably be hard-pressed to find some basketball players who want to put a peach basket up on the wall and play by the old rules, you know. But you may find some people who want to get old race cars and, you know, old technology and race cars and run them around a track. So there's certainly some things in our everyday lives where sometimes doing it the old way is kind of seen as a neat thing and, and somewhere you wouldn't dream of doing it.
Well, this becomes a little complicated because with music performance, there's this complicated relationship between scholarship and art. You know, so art is supposed to be about spontaneous and meaningful communication. Scholarship is about, you know, distance, you know, examination of the evidence. And when you start mixing those things, some interesting questions come up. So one question was, say, these period instrument people are like, yeah, it's like a Civil War reconstruction, which is cool in its own way, but what does that have to do with art? The thing that I see as a corollary is somebody out there plays the guitar. I bet a lot of people do. I know a guitarist. I don't actually know this guy, but somebody's telling me about him who owns 10 guitars. He's a studio professional. It's not like he just has an acoustic and an electric. He has like 5 different electric guitars. When he's playing rockabilly, he uses a different guitar than when he's playing, you know, punk or Jimi Hendrix or jazz or whatever. It's a different instrument that not only gets the sound right, but brings out something about the music. A lot about music. The thing about classical music is that since the middle, you know, the Renaissance, it's stuff that's written down, and that's determined a lot about what it is. But it only really happens when somebody plays it. So it's like a play. You know, the script is one thing, but it's actors who bring it to life. Musicians bring it to life. And the question is, what's written between the notes? What's that extra something that you just can't get on paper? That's really what the period instrument movement can help musicians with, who are, I think, the ones that have really made it work. It's like, this is just something that the composer assumed there'd be certain instruments used. We use very different instruments now. When you look at the way Brahms wrote for the horn, to get back to that, mm-hmm. he wouldn't have written the notes he did or the way he did if he were writing for a modern horn. Now, you know, there's nothing wrong with playing it on a modern horn, but if you're a modern horn player, maybe it just enriches your palate a little bit when you think about that stuff too. And that's what I'm hearing from horn players.
Sure. So in your – take off your scholar hat for just a moment and put on your person who programs classical music on a public radio station. If you want to play a Haydn symphony, How do you make the determination? Do you go with an orchestra that plays it using modern instruments, or do you play it with an orchestra that uses period instruments? How do you decide that?
I think it's a measure of the maturity of this thing that now I'm thinking about what's going to be the most meaningful to my listener, and that might be a period instrument performance. It depends on the conductor and the orchestra and the facts, but you know, I think if you look at what I program, you'll find some of both. With Brahms, I will typically play a modern orchestra because modern orchestras have been playing these symphonies from the day it was written. It's like something you own. It goes so deep. And yet, John Elliott Gardner's recording of these things, there's some good stuff there. So I might excerpt that once in a while. When it comes to Haydn, there's this one conductor who, if to people who listen to me on classical, his name is Franz Bruggen. He does Haydn so well that you'll hear a lot of him. But I play a lot of modern conductors in Haydn too. You know, so I'm eclectic. What I don't have is a sense of it's right or wrong. I have a sense of does it work for the people who are listening to this station right now.
Okay, let's step back a little bit and maybe take an example that's a little more easy to understand. Let's take Bach 2 and 3 part inventions.
Yeah.
Would you play Glenn Gould playing it on the piano, or would you play somebody performing it on the harpsichord for which it was originally written?
And that's an unusual case because what Bach was really doing in those pieces is showing his sons how to write in two parts.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like he cared that much if it was the harpsichord. They would practice it on the clavichord or whatever they had around. As it happens, I'm looking for something that communicates. And occasionally I'll hear a harpsichord that is so beautifully recorded that anybody would like it. It's just, you know, beautiful harpsichord. But usually I'll play the piano because that lets you hear like those three voices in a three-part invention really clearly, and makes them come to life.
Okay, so every once in a while, I will watch the tennis channel on cable, and they'll have like a 1976 game between Jimmy Connors and Bjorn Borg.
Yeah,
and you know they had those wooden rackets, and the head of them was barely bigger than a ball, and Connors will hit a forehand, and it'll go right down the line, and just land perfectly where no one in the world could ever hit this, and I appreciate it for being a good forehand, and I forget that he had equipment at the time that was really kind of inferior to what tennis players use now. So I bring that up to say, is that the same thing that may be the way to evaluate performance? Does it speak to you? And it's not about, you know, does the horn have keys or not, or were the violin strings gut or steel, but does it move you?
Does it speak to you is really what I care about. And I think that's where musicians have come to today. But of course, they have to play the notes. And, you know, thinking about whatever issues, could be a lot of different things, can help a musician who's played Brahms 100 times to make it fresh, to see it in a new way that makes them, that lets them give it their all. And I think the other thing about it is, you know, it's a really good example for another reason. It's like the question of what is progress? Well, there's no question when you're talking about athletic equipment, generally speaking, it allows performance that was impossible a generation ago. Actually, that's true of orchestral instruments. You can play more in tune, louder, more cleanly than you could, but is there a trade-off? You know, maybe with sports you'll get more injuries. Maybe with music you lose some of the expressive capacities that the older instrument had, even though you're playing it more, it's cleaner, you know. So these are the issues that musicians are grappling with.
Barney Sherman, classical music host, published author on Brahms and instrumental performance. Thank you for joining us on Talk of Iowa.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
Okay, we got a group of economists in here to talk about Iowa State University Extension, communications, and market news, and radio, and I'm going to start with the left and go over to the right. Roger Ginder is here. Good morning, Roger. How are you?
Good morning, Doug.
Get the mic closer to you. Haven't I taught you anything over all these years?
Yeah.
Of course, you've missed your last 16 appointments here.
Yeah, I have, but I got the good ones, Doug. And I really appreciate the opportunity and the service you provided at certain key times when we've had things like Hedge to Arrive and Starlink and so forth to really get the word out and and make information much more broadly available at a time when people needed it.
Well, I appreciate that. Next to you is Mark Edelman.
We're kind of a cluster of economists that do the Monday morning radio thing with you since you've been here. Most of us, well, actually all of us, I think, have been here longer than you have, so we can remember some of those times back there in the 90s. And I think back to that particular time when you started, we were probably talking about getting out of the effects of the farm finance crisis and beginning to talk about large hog confinements. I know we spent some time doing programs on House File 519 as we were trying to figure out how we were going to manage that process. It's now, looking back 20 years ago, it seems a little different because we've had such a drop in hog producers the last few years that showed up in the last census. But that's, you know, that's kind of things that we talked about. You know, it was interesting when I came in here and went down to the men's room, I noticed that there was a sign by the hand dryer there that said push button for message from Cooper.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what's that all about?
What, did you push the button?
yeah, but the only thing that came out was hot air.
This is William Edwards, Farm Management Extension Specialist here, and I think I started doing these Monday morning radio tapes in about 1975, which was actually about 15 years before Doug Cooper came on.
Actually, I was here then because I worked for Dale Williams in 1975 and 76, and I remember you then.
Dale Williams, who passed away last year. Did the farm interviews, farm facts interviews in those days. And following Dale, we had Roger Brown for a number of years and then followed by Doug Cooper. So we've had quite a tradition over the years. I remember they were supposed to be 4 minutes in length, and Dale and Roger were pretty meticulous about that. If you went 10 seconds over, you were in trouble. Now, I appreciate that, Doug, you've been very casual about that. I think we've gone 5, 6, 7 minutes sometimes if we had a good topic, and that's nice that we don't have to push everything into a certain framework. Think about some of the things that we've talked about. Of course, coming up with a new topic each time isn't always easy. Sometimes there just isn't much going on. But I guess we could thank the USDA for many, many programs. As long as we have a new farm bill every few years, there's always something new to talk about. We've gone through Freedom to Farm and ACRE and SURE.
Can you remember what all the acronyms stand for?
I don't think I can remember all the acronyms that we've been through, but there's always a few nuances to talk about. And certainly in the early 90s, those were important programs. It did help pull us out of some of the farm crisis of the 1980s, and they were very useful. I think along with that, we've seen crop insurance basically transformed from a yield disaster program to a revenue program. I believe in the mid-90s we started with crop revenue insurance, and that's pretty much what the whole market is now. And so as those things have evolved, I think we've always tried to keep farmers and people that work with farmers up to date on some of the nuances of those programs, and it's been a very useful exercise. So.
Hi, Doug. Well, Bob Jolly. I've been here since 1979, and so I precede you by a little bit. And I echo William's comments, you know, that the access to you and your predecessors as far as getting the word out on important topics quickly to a broad audience has always really been essential in the kind of work that we do. One of my roles, since I work on the finance side mostly, is I tend to play the role of Dr. Doom, you know, as when farm incomes plunge or problems with the banking industry that serves agriculture. It always seemed that I was the purveyor of bad news, but I appreciate my colleagues who got to talk about all of the farm programs and so forth that created income rather than lost it. So at any rate, it's been a good 30 years to work with this activity, and we're hope something continues along these lines.
Dan Otto?
Okay. Hi, Doug. I've been here since 1981, and I remember the old studio with a recording technician there, and now we've evolved or devolved to Doug's man cave over here with digital recording equipment. My role has been usually to maybe translate some of these activities in the farm sector to implications for rural economies or the communities, you know, that the synergy between the farm and community. So there's been a lot of events over the years that spike up attention. We had go back to the drought years of 83. Combined pick and drought was a lot of interest in activities there. The farm financial crisis spilling over to communities. The couple major floods, 93 and 2008, had a lot of implications for communities that were affected. So there was always been plenty of material. The biofuels, the ethanol growth, and, I guess, changes in the hog industry, too. That was a big change over the years, and always a lot of interest in what it means for the general economy, how important is agriculture to rural places and the state's economy. So there's been plenty of material for Monday morning coming over here.
Mike Duffy milked the land values thing into, 12 months a year. Always could talk about that. You inherited that from Jolly, though, didn't you?
Yeah, I don't even know what to say to that.
What was it when Jolly gave you the land value survey? What had he done to the land value?
Well, you notice I took it over, and it only took me a year to make it recover. So I, unfortunately, Dean Comer at that time didn't do anything about a raise, but it only took a year, and with the exception of a couple of bumps in the road, we've been doing okay on that. I just echo what's been said about enjoying being over here and having the opportunity to work with you, and I think mostly it's been kind of the spontaneity of it. You just generally throw a topic out to you, and then 12 minutes later, 15 minutes later, I shut up, and you go, oh, man, this is four programs. So it's like William said, we did the five-minute or four-minute was not too bad. The old place had the clock on the wall where you watched exactly how much time you had, but it has been fun, and everything's changing. So this is all a part of it. I look around the room here at my colleagues, and I know at least one of them's won't be here next month. And we're getting down pretty soon. We could do this interview in a phone booth, but it's been fun, and I've enjoyed working with you. The one thing that I do have to say, I always found it a little unsettling where we would have our Christmas parties over in Hetty Hall, and here we are in a jovial mood, not wanting to think about much of anything, and Doug would walk in with his microphone and stick it in front of your face. Well, you're live on WOI. What do you have to say? other than get that thing out of my face. But anyway, it's been fun.
It has. We've done some things. And, when I first started doing the interviews that we did them over at WOI, Pete Lawrence was the engineer that handled everything. He passed away a little over a year ago. He made it easy. I just had to sit in a table, and the light would come on, and I'd talk. When 4 minutes were up, the light would go off. And that's how that worked back in those days. 4 minutes, light comes on, light goes out, you're done. Well, we're going to talk some more here. We're going to talk soybean today. It's been a while since I've been able to coerce Pella Peterson to stop by and see me. Pella, you've been pretty busy here the last month or so.
Well, I think the last year, Doc, has been extremely hectic. But particularly this fall, after harvest, it was important for us to get our data out, and we were probably 3 to 4 weeks later out of the fields that we normally will be in a normal year. And then after that, I had a couple of international trips I was lucky to be part of. And then, of course, Christmas, and And since Christmas, then we have been busy with Crop Advantage Series and traveling all over the state. And so, yeah, so I haven't been laying at home on the couch, if that's what you tried to tell me. So.
Well, you've been shoveling snow. I mean, you've had probably some difficulty getting to some of these events, I would guess.
Well, I've been in Iowa for 7 years, and this year we had to cancel 2 Crop Advantage Series. And of course, when you're sitting in your office in the morning and you get an email from Brent Preckness tell us that it's canceled, you say, yes, I don't have to drive 20 miles an hour for 10 hours to get somewhere. But of course, it's not fun that you can't go out there and tell the growers in that area what you have learned over the years and what you would like them to try to improve the operation.
Tell me how the soybean industry and the soybean production has changed. You started in February 2003?
That's correct. And, you know, it's all those 7 years, you know, we have seen a lot of consolidations, you know. You know, the big companies are getting bigger, and you're losing a lot of the small companies. So you don't have as many family-owned companies out there anymore. It's very cutthroat, if you can call it that. It's poor business, clean business. You don't really have a lot of if you don't have a big research project, it's really tough for them to stay in the business. You know, you always have to move forward, and it's a very competitive business today. It was in 2003 when I got here as well, but I really think it's intensified over the last couple of years.
Well, you know, one of the things you did when you first came here, I remember one of the first interviews I did with you in 2003, you talked about the challenge that you were going to present farmers to produce 100 bushel soybean. I remember looking at you going, okay.
Yeah, well, it has been a challenge, Doc, but I think we have done very well. If you look, you know, I've been through here for 7 growing seasons, and we have had 5 years above 50 average across the state, I think. We're doing well. We only did that once before I got here. So I think farmers understand now what it takes to maximize yield. There are still a lot of things we're not doing good enough. You know, like we're still planting way too late. Everybody needs to be done by May 15. And we still do not pay enough attention to variety selection. We need to work closer with our seed company and our agronomist so we don't pick a failure, you know, or pick a variety that could fail. And then the weed management, particularly here the last couple of years, you know, we start getting back to looking at very weedy fields that was very common here in the 80s. So, and that's, of course, with the, you know, we can talk to Elvin about that, but we have had very wet springs. 6 out of the 7 years I've been here, I will define it as wet springs. And if you can't get your post-emergent herbicide on time, weeds get big and it costs us yield. So that's there have been things that have been changing, but I think growers are doing very well. I wouldn't say that they should be proud of themselves, but we're doing better. And I told growers that at this winter meetings that if we get a normal year, we're going to average 60 across Iowa. We have the tools now. Farmers understand it. Give us an average growing season, and particularly not a too wet of a spring, and they will be surprised what kind of yields they can get.
You say planting early is the way to maximize soybean yield.
Well, Doctor,
how much earlier is that than the traditional thinking? It seems to me that we were never really concerned about getting beans in the ground until the end of May, maybe even early June was okay.
But that was when you were satisfied with these, you know, 45, 50 bushel. But if you want to make profit today, you're going to have above 60 bushel beans to have a chance to cover your cost. So we don't have a very short growing season here, and that's the problem. We're running out of time. So we have to get them planted early to take advantage of the entire growing season. And if you look at the USDA planting progress reports, half of Iowa is planted by mid-May, but we should be 100% planted by there because anybody will lose yield after there. Yes, you can still get good yields in late May, but what about if you can get even more in early May? That's my bottom line. My bottom line is we can always get more, and we should try to get as much as we can get.
Well, let's bring Elwin Taylor onto the discussion here. Elwin, have you been able to follow this, some of the impediments here to getting planted early in Iowa seems to be our spring weather?
Oh, it certainly has been, Doug. When wet springs are the problem, and we have had now 3 years in a row, the three wettest three-year run in the 150-year history of keeping good weather records in Iowa. And so I don't know if this is a climate change or we're going to be stuck with that, but I do know this, that this three-year run that we're in right now is the longest wet run and the wettest long run of consecutive years that we've had, if we want to call 3 years a run. Of course, we had this extremely wet year in 93, and everybody expected a disaster, and everybody got a disaster. But it wasn't that wet the year before, or the year after, or the year after that. And as a two-year run, last year and the year before, we had the wettest two-year run, and now the wettest three-year run that we've had since we started keeping records back in 1893.
Well, Pell, you've been here for that. Is there any correlation to Pella's presence here in Iowa?
It could, maybe I'm bringing the weather women from Northern Europe to here. I don't know.
Well, Pella, we're still glad you're here.
Well, we should mention to our listeners that this is Pella's last week.
That's right. Friday is my last day at Iowa State.
You'll be leaving us for where?
I accepted a job with Syngenta and gonna work on the seed treatment division with research, overseeing corn, soybean for U.S. as technical manager. I'll be living in Ames, staying in Ames. For several reasons, it's central in the Corn Belt, but also I'm not going to let my graduate students down. I have four students, and I want to be sure that they graduate, so I will be able to help them over the weekends until they're done. So I will be working out of my house here in the beginning for maybe a couple of years at least.
Well, I think I can speak for a lot of us who have worked with you over the 7 years. We're going to miss you, but we look forward to your new opportunities, and hopefully we'll be in touch.
Oh, for sure, Doug. I appreciate it. It's the last 7 years have been unreal, and it's been a great ride. It's been a heck of a ride, if we can call it that. And I would never have been able to have accomplished what I've done if it wasn't for the support here, and particularly the checkoff in Iowa and the growers, the Iowa Soybean Association, have been really tough. They're tough to leave because they've been so helpful to me. But I will still be the same pal, and I will still be around. So, but we also should say thank to you, Doc, because this is also your last week.
It is.
So, you know, this program has been fantastic for us in extension. You know, Roger and I, we've been here a lot. Elwin have been here a lot as well, and we couldn't have got our information out if it wasn't for you. So. Thank you to you, Sue.
Okay, well, thank you, Pella. And, yeah, Elwin, going back to the early 1990s, we reinvigorated this program, if that's the right word. We restarted it.
You know, this is a program that really has gone on for 25 years, but it did make, we thought, improvements over the years, and I think most of the people of Iowa did, not just the farmers. Of course, the majority of our audience is not farmers, but everyone in Iowa has an interest of some sort in farming. But a lot of the people that have been listening to our programs, of course, have an interest in their own particular interests, and I think that they've appreciated the programs and your presence and the programming that you've done, Doug. I'd like to thank you for it and for the many good years. And being the last week of your employment at Iowa State University, all I can say is thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate that, Elwin, and I guess we should do some real serious business here. I just got a note that my daughter's school is closing for the day. Give us in the next 50 seconds what we can expect weather-wise the rest of today.
Well, Doug, we have another Arctic outbreak. This is number three. And, of course, there's some snow going on. The heavy snow is going to be in northern Wisconsin off of Lake Superior. This snow is not connected with the Gulf of Mexico. This is just residual moisture in the air from the past warmer-than-usual week. And so it's been very fluffy snow. It's driven by cold north winds. The winds are strongest coming into northern Minnesota and eastern portions of the Dakotas. They will be easing up by tonight and tomorrow. And the temperatures, though, going to be back to the cool side of
usual. Okay. Elwin, thanks.
For a week.
We're out of time. Goodbye, everybody.